Oh, a life on the ocean wave, a home on the rolling sea, cruising with National Review. There's Rich and Jay and Jonah and Catherine and Ramesh and VDH and Kevin and Mona and Charlie and Bob and Andy and Jim and D-Roy and O'Sullivan and PJ and Miller and me. There's actually a lot more conservative talent than that out here on the balmy Caribbean, including Tim Pawlenty, of whom more a little later, John Yu, Ralph Reed, oh, too many to list, and apologies to those unmentioned. Also, of course, and the real point of the whole thing, close to 500 National Review readers and supporters, including, it seems, well nigh the entire population of La Crosse, Wisconsin. Bless every one of them, and heartfelt thanks for the many compliments and kindnesses received and books purchased. I am ensconced in my customary modest 8-room suite amidships, with my research assistants, Mandy, Candy, and Brandy. I have just finished leading them through our morning Tai Chi exercises, and they are now busy preparing the jacuzzi and stocking the bar for our party this evening. Prior to the party, this afternoon, I'm scheduled to give a talk in the ship's main auditorium on doubly periodic functions of a complex variable. I anticipate a good turnout for that. Better, I hope, anyway, than Jonah got yesterday for his rendering of Shostakovich's Fourth Symphony on the kazoo, which I thought fell somewhat flat with the audience. We're very competitive here with our presentations. One good thing about being out of the USA right now is that we are safe from being struck by Republican presidential candidates falling from the sky to crash and burn all over the landscape. It's getting to be quite a hazard. First to auger in was Rick Perry. First, second, and third, in fact, with dismal campaign performances. Remember when Perry was the anti-Romney, pulling in donor money like a Jerry Lewis telethon? Well, those days are over. Now Perry's struggling to raise enough to be competitive in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina. In mid-September, Perry was polling 32% among likely Republican voters. This week, he's down in single digits. Bloomberg News quotes an anonymous Perry fundraiser saying he'd gotten back 15 RSVPs for a recent event. That's 15 potential donors saying they'd attend the event. And then there was another debate in which Perry took off his left shoe and chewed on it. And when the event took place, none of the 15 showed up. Poor Rick Perry must be feeling like that Elizabethan poet who wrote the line, "They flee from me that sometime me did seek." Things got worse this week when the Texas governor, having already ticked off us immigration restrictionists by telling us we have no heart if we don't favour government benefits for illegals, he then managed to offend immigration promoters by excluding non-citizens from one of his town hall meetings in New Hampshire. The meeting was at a facility belonging to a company named Granite State Manufacturing, which does some contract work for the Defense Department. Because of that, claimed the company, federal regulations forbid them allowing non-citizens into events they're hosting. I have no idea if federal regulations actually do say that, but there was a company employee at the door of the hall among the Perry staffers demanding proof of citizenship from the people coming in. That seems fair enough to me. It's an election event, for crying out loud, and non-citizens can't vote, except, of course, in Chicago. So, why would they want to attend a campaign event anyway? The open borders shills, of course, don't see it that way. To them, the whole notion of citizenship is just a racist plot against their human rights. for a defence contractor to bar non-citizens from company premises is pretty much equivalent to burning crosses on people's lawns. Here's someone named Eva Milona, executive director of the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition. Quote, "It's disturbing. I find that discriminatory." End quote. Heaven forbid anyone should ever, in any way whatsoever, discriminate between citizens and non-citizens. Except, of course, when giving benefits to non-citizens that aren't available to citizens, as Rick Perry has done. It's quite an achievement, ticking off both sides of the immigration issue, but somehow Rick Perry's pulled it off. For his next trick, the governor will alienate both NARAL and the Right to Life movement, both in the same day, before lunch. So there goes Rick Perry. Let's see if I have a crash and burn sound clip. Yeah, that'll do. So, who else have we got? Well, we've got Herman Cain, though for how much longer is a bit of an open question. Herb's been having his own gaff-o-rama. A couple of weeks ago, there was that business with charges of so-called sexual harassment from women Cain worked with 15 years ago. That was all squashed when Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, Eric Holder, and President Obama himself all denounced the charges as motivated by racist stereotypes of successful black males. Following those denunciations, nobody dared even mention the sexual harassment charges. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, I'm sorry. That all happened in the bizarro world into which I occasionally slip through a crack in the space-time continuum, unfortunately located right next to my liquor cabinet. In the actual world, the sexual harassment charges are still in play, and there have been a total of, let me see, yes, zero, a total of zero recorded comments from Jesse, Al, Eric, and Barry. We here at Radio Derb will continue to poo-poo the charges until we run out of poo-poo. The main issue these last few days, though, has been Herb's ignorance of anything that has ever happened, is happening, or might happen, beyond the borders, if you'll excuse such a politically incorrect word, of the USA. In the matter of presidential ignorance about this or that, I'm easygoing. Nobody knows everything about everything, and in fact, in my experience, very few of us know much about much. When Dwight Eisenhower ascended to the presidency in 1953, he knew everything it's possible to know about organizing a huge army to invade and take back an occupied continent from a determined enemy. That's a heck of a skill set to have. However, Ike didn't know any more about economics or diplomacy or education or transportation than John Q. Public. And during the 8 years he was president, that tremendous army organizing skill set was not called upon. Those 8 years were, however, pretty good years for the USA. Kind of golden age, in fact, to hear older Americans talk about them, before all the disruptions of the 60s. So, comprehensive knowledge about absolutely everything is not on my list of presidential qualifications. There are limits to the degree of candidate ignorance I'm willing to tolerate, though, and I think Herb has breached those limits. Among the qualities a president needs, I'd include a certain level of imagination, so that the chief executive can project himself into situations that might occur, and figure out in advance what kinds of options he might have. To arrive at your mid-60s without ever having paid a moment's attention to what's happening in China or Africa or Europe, as is plainly the case with Herb, bespeaks a quite astonishing lack of imagination. Then, fresh from revealing that he thought Libya was the brand name of a bathroom disinfectant, Herb went off to Florida and made two more gaffes back to back. Gaffe one, quote from Herb, addressing a rally in Palm Beach County, quote, "When the American people begin to ignite that American spirit, they make things happen, just like they made things happen in 2008, when the Republicans took back control of the House," end quote. Sorry, Herb, that was 2010. Gaffe 2. Chasing the Cuban exile vote in Miami, Herb accepted a cup of coffee from a vendor. He thought it was delicious and wanted to say so. So he asked the vendor, "How do you say delicious in Cuban?" Somewhat similar to how you'd say it in Austrian would be my guess. But look, you can get away with an occasional one of these gaffes, especially, of course, if you're a Democrat who the media are desperately trying to help get elected. Herb's gaffes are piling up, though, and are reaching some sort of critical mass. Sorry, Herb. You're a nice guy, and I hate to see a fellow math geek crash and burn, but that's what you're doing. And then Newt Gingrich. With the air going out of the Perry and Kaine campaigns, and Mitt Romney bumping his head up against the 26% ceiling of Republicans who can bear the thought of voting for him without a prior shot of Novocaine, Newt was having a boom, or at least a boomlet, in the polls. Then came the Big Mac attack. That's Freddie Mac, more properly the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation, which is about as close to being a genuine, actual corporation as the People's Liberation Army is, and just about as likely to go out of business. Freddie Mac buys up mortgage loans, bundles them into bonds, and sells the bonds to investors. As the mortgage holders pay off their mortgages, the money flows through to the bonds' coupon payments. The loans are bundled up in such a way that even if some statistical proportion of mortgages default, there's enough sound ones in the bundle to keep the funds flowing. And in any case, the whole game is backed with government guarantees. What could possibly go wrong? A major housing crash, that's what. Freddie Mac lost billions in the 2008 crisis, and it's now run by federal regulators. In other words, nobody any longer pretends that this is a genuine corporation. It's just another federal welfare agency, and also a luxury retirement home for well-connected Washington insiders, who get sinecure positions worth millions with Freddie Mac, working 2 hours a month as bogus executives and consultants. And now we know that that latter category included Newt Gingrich. Newt, we've just learned, was hired in as a consultant by Freddie Mac in 1999 and stayed one for 9 years until the whole shebang lost the farm and was put under those federal regulators. During that time, Newt was paid a sum of money somewhere between $1.6 and $1.8 million, depending on who's doing the estimating. Newt himself says he just doesn't remember. You know how a couple of $1 million can slip your mind. It's not hard to figure why Freddie Mac would want to hire Gingrich. The guy is well connected with Republicans and with Republican-friendly, or at least not hostile, media outlets like Fox News. By the late 90s, congressional Republicans were already beginning to figure out that government involvement in mortgage lending could only lead to disaster, as indeed it eventually did. There were moves to cut back or even shut down the activities of Freddie Mac. The Freddie Mac executives naturally wanted someone with credibility in the GOP to swing opinion their way a bit. Newt's trying to jiu-jitsu the whole thing, telling us that his experience as a shill for Freddie Mac gave him valuable insider understanding of governmental affairs. Isn't that what we want in a candidate? Valuable insider understanding of governmental affairs? Quote from Newt on the campaign trail in Iowa on Wednesday, quote, "It reminds people that I know a great deal about Washington. We just tried 4 years of amateur ignorance and it didn't work very well. So having someone who actually knows Washington might be a really good thing," end quote. That's a bit like a rabbit applying for a management position on a lettuce farm. Why not? He knows all there is to know about lettuce. Newt's chutzpah knows no bounds, though. Back during the 2008 presidential campaign, he told a Fox News interviewer that then-Senator Obama ought to return contributions he'd received from Freddie Mac and its sister racket, Fannie Mae. Just last year, Newt brought out a book, a campaign book, in which he argued for getting rid of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. Now, here he is in Iowa this week, defending Freddie Mac. Quote, "Every American should be interested in expanding housing opportunities," end quote. As a conservative Republican, I would reply that every American should be interested in getting government out of activities where it has no legitimate function, and that would include mortgage lending to homebuyers. The phrase "expanding housing opportunities" is pure Democrat speak, the kind of phrase that drops naturally from the lips of a Pelosi or a Barney Frank. It has no place in the vocabulary of a Republican. An American has a housing opportunity when he's saved up enough for a deposit and has a good enough credit record to ask a bank for a loan under proper objective credit criteria, undistorted by political interference. Mortgage lending has been utterly corrupted by government manipulation, by administrations from Jimmy Carter's to George W. Bush's, to the immense detriment of our economy at large. We now know that Newt Gingrich was a willing agent of that corruption. If he can survive our knowing that, the anti-Romney sentiment must be mighty indeed. I don't believe it is that mighty. I say, Newt is toast. So, who does that leave us with? Well, if you lift your eyes from the fireballs and smoke plumes of GOP candidates crashing and burning at all points of the compass, there, floating serenely high above it all, is the Romney blimp. Come the general next fall, I and all the conservative Republicans I know will be voting for anyone against Obama. I think it's fair to say, though, that among the people we might be voting for, Mitt Romney is the one that inspires the least enthusiasm. Is there any way out of this? Michelle Bachmann seems to be dead in the water for reasons I don't understand. I'd be happy to vote for her in the general. Ron Paul remains Ron Paul. Brilliantly right about most things, but old, cranky, an outsider to the GOP establishment, and as unattractive as it's possible to be to Mr. and Mrs. Independent. Rick Santorum? Too easy a target for the lefty media assassins. And what if Mitt Romney isn't around next fall? There could be a major gaffe or a scandal. He could fall off a stage or get hit by a truck. Mitt's a nice guy, and heaven forfend any of the foregoing. But stuff happens. Then we're going to need some last-minute rescue by an outsider. Who, though? Rudy? Chris Christie? There are negatives all over. Paging Tim Pawlenty. Paging Tim Pawlenty. Meanwhile, the nation's fiscal crisis continues on its way to the lip of Niagara. Tuesday this week, federal government debt exceeded $15 trillion for the first time ever. Who's the biggest holder of all that debt? The Federal Reserve, that's who. And if you think there must be some subtle, deep financial wisdom in Uncle Sam owing trillions of dollars to himself, you're mistaken. It's just exactly as crazy as it sounds, if not more so. If you break down the $15 trillion, near to $5 trillion of it is what is politely called intragovernmental debt. That's when the Treasury pulls money out of, for instance, the Social Security Trust Fund, replacing all those nice crispy dollars with a slip of paper bearing the letters I-O-U. Of the remaining $10 trillion and change, $1.7 trillion is held by the Fed, $1.1 trillion is held by our dear friends in Peking, $3.5 trillion is held by other governments, and roughly the same amount is held by non-governments, which means banks, investment funds, and actual persons. If those static numbers made your eyes glaze over, the really interesting thing to look at is what we math folk call the first derivative, which is to say, the rate of change. Remember I said the Fed holds $1.7 trillion of Treasury debt? That is more than twice what they held this time last year. Contrary-wise, Chinese holdings of US debt declined a tad since 1 year ago, down by $36 billion. So, look for the silver lining here. We may owe a ton more money to ourselves, but we owe a wee bit less to the Chi-Coms. If that's a comfort to you, it really shouldn't be. The political temperature went up a degree or two in the Western Pacific this week, with Barack Obama announcing deployment of 2,500 Marines to Australia, and the Chi-Coms snarling about encirclement and provocation. I don't know, I'm getting deja vu here. I grew up in a country that had been top dog in the world for a century or so, and just couldn't forget it. The British newspapers of my childhood were full of debates about how much of a role Britain should have in policing the world. The idea that we should have some role being assumed by almost everyone. You heard the phrase, east of Suez, a lot. How many troops should we maintain east of Suez? One of our prime ministers, Sir Alec Douglas-Hume, said that Britain should always, quote, punch above her weight in international affairs. The fact that Britain had been bankrupted by World War II and had deep systemic social and economic problems that no one was willing to face up to make it all look very unrealistic in retrospect. At the time, though, nobody could see that. And here I am in the USA, 50 years later, and our president is sending troops to Uganda and Australia. I have no clue why anyone thinks we have any national interest in Uganda. In the matter of Australia, I can pass on this from the news report. The Marine deployment there is intended to, quote, shore up our alliances in the region, says the White House. Alliances against whom? Oh, right, against China, which holds $1.17 trillion of our debt, and whose economy and political stability depends on selling stuff to us. Meanwhile, the Federal Reserve in a single year took $850 billion out of one national trouser pocket and moved it to the other one. Like I said, it's déjà vu. Or am I trapped in the pathetic fallacy? I'm not sure, but if you ask me to rank possible threats to the peace and order of the world, I'd rank a Chinese invasion of Australia down somewhere below a plague of frogs. Quote of the week from back in New York. Quote, on the 17th, we're going to burn New York City to the ground. No more talking. They've got guns. We've got bottles. They've got bricks. We've got rocks. In a few days, you're going to see what a Molotov cocktail can do to Macy's. End quote. That was a chap named Nkrumah Tinsley. I assume Mr. Tinsley's forename honours Kwame Nkrumah, the flamboyant socialist president of Ghana back in the 1960s, whose grandiose schemes set back the development of that country for years. Mr. Tinsley belongs, of course, to the Occupy Wall Street movement, whose camp in downtown Manhattan was dispersed by police on Tuesday, although not, as Radio Derb has been urging, with high-pressure water hoses and 5,000-gallon helicopter drops of ammonia disinfectant. I hope Mr. Tinsley won't take it amiss if I offer him a word or two of advice. Just this, Nkrumah. When, quote from you, they've got guns, we've got bottles, you're facing a problem in what military analysts call correlation of forces. Just something for you to think about. Meanwhile, as Radio Derb goes to tape, the Occupy Wall Street rabble are promising new demonstrations. They say they're going to occupy the subway system. So, the New York subway is going to fill up with smelly, obnoxious riders jumping the turnstiles and yelling abuse at the tops of their voices. Who will notice? Quote from the Occupy Wall Street website, quote, we will no longer tolerate the oppression of the 1% who do not want to see a creative movement based on inclusiveness and tolerance triumph over a system deeply rooted in social inequality, end quote. So, this movement is creative? Can anyone name a single thing they have created? And since inclusiveness and tolerance invariably end up needing lots and lots of government revenue to support them, and since the operations of Wall Street make up well-nigh New York City's entire tax base and a major chunk of New York State, just tell me again how closing down Wall Street promotes your socialist project. And if social inequality is the one great evil, how is it that every attempt to erase it, all through human history, from the Spartacus Rebellion to modern Cuba and North Korea, ends up with a heap of corpses and a living population of listless peasants in rags? I do my best to be charitable towards those with opinions different from my own, but I have to confess, in regard to the Occupy Wall Street crowd, I no longer feel that fire hoses and air drops of ammonia really meet the case. How about we let them occupy the subway? Then, when they're all down there, just seal off all the stations and let them ride round and round for a couple of weeks among the rats and the stinky winos and the sour-faced, unresponsive token booth clerks. At least it'd give them some experience of what people who have to go to work for a living put up with. And now, Radio Derb's closing miscellany of brief items. Item, watch where you're walking. The current fad for stealing metal to sell to scrap merchants has reached the drain and manhole covers that adorn our streets. Or at least in Britain it has. In West Sussex, a woman fell 20 feet into a sewer via a manhole, the metal cover of which had been taken by thieves. Fortunately, she was not badly hurt and managed to call police, who extricated her. In related news from across the pond, 42-year-old Darren Wayne Law served very briefly as ground connection to a 6,600-volt electric cable he was attempting to steal. Having apparently paid insufficient attention in his school science classes, Mr. Law used, for access to the cable he wanted to steal, he used an aluminum ladder. He is now the late Mr. Law. And to add to those two incidents, one stinking and one shocking, here's a batch that are just sickening. In the run-up to Remembrance Day, which is what November the 11th is called in Britain, a number of war memorials across the UK have had their metal plaques stolen. Usually made of bronze, these plaques bear the names of local people who died in the World Wars. Item. Remember the super committee of six Republican and six Democrat Congress critters that was set up to resolve the nation's debt problem? Guess what? With 4 days to go to their deadline, they just can't agree. What a surprise. Quote from Associated Press, quote, "A sense of deep pessimism has gripped the super committee. And judging from the limited public statement by panel members, a debt bargain could be out of reach," end quote. Well, you could knock me down with a feather. The Democrats want more taxation and increased benefit programs. The Republicans want tax reform and benefit cuts. Most of the give has been from the GOP side, with John Boehner endorsing a $300 billion tax hike over 10 years. Conservative Republicans are balking at that, though, and anyway the Democrats want a trillion. So that's the quarrel that's going on in the canoe. You know, the canoe that's heading for the lip of the waterfall. Item, here's a sort of mathematical news item. Afghan President Hamid Karzai, I forgot to include his middle name. Here it is. Karzai summoned a meeting of Afghan tribal elders, a lawyer jirga. Unfortunately, the number of elders he summoned was 39. That's a problem because Afghans consider 39 to be a shameful number, associated with pimps. No one really knows the reason for this, though a common theory is that a famous pimp had the number 39 on his vehicle license plate. Anyway, elders were refusing to show up at the meeting, saying they'd be insulted when they got back home to their tribal areas for having participated in a party of 39. This strikes me as the weirdest story of the week. I mean, who even knew they had pimps in Afghanistan? How many goats does an Afghan pimp typically have on the street at one time? 39, perhaps. Look, I just report these stories. That's it from the sunny Caribbean, folks. From the cruise ship Eurodam, stateroom number, 69. Nothing salacious about that anyway, thank goodness. I wouldn't want the girls to feel embarrassed. We'll be back on shore next week with more news and views post-cruise from Radio Durban.